Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
We're going to talk about scalability, and we'll talk very openly about the challenges that scalability has. And some people, I don't know who talked to us, they said, oh, we have scalability figured out on the app level and the compute layer, and that's true. And once it gets to data, it gets somewhat delicate. And again, Mark will have a whole section on data partitioning and what you do, why you do, and so forth. because there is a long history of scalability that we have pursued as a company and as the industry. And there's lots of opinions about it, neither are right or wrong. But at the end of the day, it's all about how do you get to a higher level of users in the system without blocking each other and protecting the integrity of the data. That's really the trade-off that you're making. And at the end of the day, most applications in most customers are actually not scalable, and they don't need to be. So I talked to a very, very big customer in the insurance business, and they talked to me about their enterprise systems. They have three of them. They have SharePoint and Exchange as the business productivity collaboration environment, and they have SAP as their ERP system. Those are the only systems that they had that had enterprise scale, that every employee was supposed to use and all processes were using in the case of the ERP system. Everything else was 20 users, 30 users, departments level scale, workloads, workgroup scale, and so forth. So having a non-scaled approach is perfectly fine. So somebody asked me, do we always have to decompose? Do we always have to do all the stuff you worked us through? And the answer is no. If you have no scaling requirements and very simple availability requirements that are non-differentiated, that's perfectly fine. I would still look at composition-based approaches in terms of component-based approaches and having your code clean and modular and so forth, but that's more of a code hygiene efficiency question, not a scalability availability question. Then for a very long time, we went into the obtain a larger box mode, mainframe. Most of you were not at Microsoft when Windows NT effectively created a new market. SMP, as symmetric multiprocessing, was around for quite some time, but Microsoft, plus together with Intel, in the NT timeframe, we created the four-node SMP standard. Industrialized hardware, it was cheap to a degree, and we did that. And NT changed the way we think about apps and servers and scalability completely. And now we are at 256 cores, the equivalent of a CPU in those days, and we can host a terabyte of RAM or more. So we do support scale-up outside of the cloud. The cloud just doesn't do that. And then you do scale-out, which is a bigger box, but completely consistent. The two models that I know about, and I'm sure the group knows about more, Oracle Rack is one of those systems, which is effectively scaling out and has number of nodes in it, but it's a virtual bigger box. But it keeps it consistent, and if you look at a mainframe, you look at DB2 Sysplex, that's the other environment that does a lot of these kind of characteristics. The problem with this model of scale-out is there is a limit of scale-out. It's higher than a single box, but it's not unlimited. A lot of people read marketing collateral from our competitors there, and it's quote-unquote unlimited scale. Unlimited for a very long time, because I think the maximum for Oracle Rack, for example, is theoretically 64 nodes, but since they synchronize using a SAN, there is an I.O. limit on the synchronization circles that they're going to run between the various nodes. And then you have this extreme scale models, which is about partitioning. And everything Microsoft invests in is about extreme scale and focusing on partitioning. So at this point in time, we're not focusing on this scale-out model. We're focusing on that scale-out model as a company. So if you like this model, there are market alternatives they don't provide from Microsoft at this point in time, because we are focusing here due to the simple fact that we have no, that the industry drive, let's call it that, is focusing on unknown scale. You can go from zero to very small to very, very large with a single model. The model is more complex than, for example, this model, but it is unlimited in terms of scale. And that's really the reason why we are investing the way we are investing. So those are the four models that we as an industry provide and consider. And none of them is right or wrong. It really depends on what you want to do. And Microsoft will continue to support this, and we will invest here very heavily as a company. Again, one of the ways we're looking at easing some of the complexities in the extreme scale-out model is the federation model. And the SQL team has done a number of investments in that area. The first version was pretty okay, but had some scalability improvements that were required based upon customer requirements and demand. And so the team is working on a much improved version. Is it already out or is it coming out? I don't even know.
What I would suggest is that there's what's there. If you're doing anything of significant size, there's some great white papers on the WindowsAzure.com architecture area.
Yep.
And I would look to those unless you've got some more moderate or smaller implementations.
Yeah. So again, the solution works, but at extreme scale, we still have some improvements to do. It was a V0.1 or 1.0, depending on how you look at it. But the idea is simple, that you look at it from your application perspective, that is if it were a single namespace integrated, and underneath the covers, the technology will shard it out for you transparently. With all of those things, always remember when the system does that, it's a generic model, which means it could be very good for you, but you lose a certain set of control. If you do manual partitioning, along the lines of what Mark is going to talk about, you have absolute control of what gets placed where and when. This federation-based approach leaves you with a much simpler application view, but it is more generic, and hence it makes abstractions and it makes trade-offs between a certain set of things that you might not be able to control. And so always keep in mind, partitioning ought to be something that you understand, and then if you're okay with the federation approach, the way the system does it, then go with that. Scalability. We talked about scale units since quite some time, and scale units is not a single VM. You should think about scale units as all the resources you're required to provide service for a given capacity. Let me unravel that sentence a little bit. Enterprise capacity planning, and I've done my fair share of that, is effectively understanding requirements, understanding use cases, and then you kind of get the buffering, meaning people will then add risk to it and saying, I don't really know, so I'm going to add stuff to it, 20%, 25%, 50%. We've all been there, depending on how well you thought the data was being collected or validated, you kind of went to the risk side. And capacity planning also said, I have to plan for the maximum point of usage. So if you look at any enterprise system, inside Microsoft, outside Microsoft, it doesn't matter, all of those systems are provisioned for the extreme point of usage. Let me give you some examples for extreme points of usage. There are certain pizza chains in the US of A that make 40% of their yearly revenue on one Sunday. That Sunday happened 2 weeks ago, or last week Sunday. It's called Super Bowl, because everybody sits at home or with friends, and everybody seems to be eat pizza. And so 40% of their yearly revenue happens that day. And in the old days, before they actually, at least one of them, went to Windows Azure, they were provisioning the server environment for the entire year for that one Sunday in their data center. And that was running statically, because we don't really know how to deal with change in data centers. We're not very good at it. It takes forever to provision things, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So capacity planning is when you design for extreme scale and have it deployed pretty much static. You don't really touch it. Scale units on the other side simply say, hey, wait a second, I don't know what my demand is, or my demand fluctuates. So what I want to do is I want to design, instead of for an ultimate number of users, I will actually take a given capacity and say, for, with this much of compute, storage, and network, I can support this many things, be they users, be they transactions, be there other things that you might run. So score tickers, live tickers, that's the unit you might want to care. So don't just go into this note that, oh, it's all about users. It might not be. It depends on what your system does or what it is, where your unit of scale might be different. There is a terminology that's called, you need to understand your growth factors. What makes your system grow or shrink, depending on where you go in terms of the going up or down. Think Hotmail. Again, Hotmail started this a long time ago. They might not have called it scale units, but that's what they did. A scale unit in Hotmail is now determined by their storage size. So they take a given block of storage, and they think in petabytes, not in giga or terabytes, and they think about provisioning that block of storage and the accompanying set of machines that support that service. And they know, with based upon their historical data that they now have gathered for a long time, how many users can I support with a given block of storage, and that's how they plan. And the system is scaled out from end to end, meaning from the front end to the middle tier to the storage environment, it's a scale-out partition system. So they can actually literally put another big block of storage plus the machines in place, and another one, and another one, and they scale out horizontally. Works beautifully for them. And they can play around with some of the numbers of servers in terms of the app servers. The storage is fixed in the sense of you can't really scale down storage except if you deprovision users. That also happens, but very rarely, that kind of thing. So always think about elasticity in terms of growing, and then think through how do you shrink things. On the storage side or persistent data side, it's not as easy, because a lot of that time you don't want to get rid of that data. You want to keep it, but it's not necessarily accessed by all these users at the same time. That's why most likely you will have scale units that differentiate between persistent data and transient activity oriented resources like session data and users and that kind of thing. And so you will take those differently. So what you look at is to define the resources for a given set of capacity. A million transactions, 10,000 users, whatever the unit is, and don't make it too big. Because, as I said, this is designed for unknown scale, but don't make it too small either. Meaning, if you get down to a single VM, you might not have picked the right scale unit. Because you said, man, I want at least two or three VMs to grow, because it takes time to provision and configure these things, even for a system as sophisticated as Windows Azure is. And again, this could be users, concurrent users, response time, transaction numbers, that kind of thing will drive it. And it goes against any workload. If you look at Exchange or SharePoint as two great examples, SharePoint has created a conceptual boundary inside their data layer called a site collection. And that sites collection is their scale unit for data scaling. That's what they do. If you're not a SharePoint guy, you say, don't understand that. But what they did, instead of coming up with a flat namespace for all of their documents and collaboration sites, they introduced this conceptual artifact called a site collection. And within the site collection, you have sites, and a site is then the artifact that really holds documents and users and threats and whatnot that you can hide. And so they deliberately went after this partitioning model all the way from their front-end architecture to their application servers to their data strategy. Exchange does the same thing, where they actually have, I don't know what the proper name is, but effectively their messaging database space, and that's partitionable. And that's also a unit of integrity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is always design for what a given capacity. Do not design for absolute capacity. Designed for given capacity in a responsible way based upon your scenario. So 100 user provisioning units might not be such a great idea if you go into the hundreds of thousands of users or millions. 5,000 for an enterprise scenario might be a good thing. So Microsoft Services is now on the way to go to product line architectures for a lot of our investments for SharePoint modeling and Exchange and so forth, how we deploy these things. And we have picked for Exchange, for example, it's a 5,000 unit scale unit with a given set of mailbox attributes that we manage. And so we kind of design 5,000 users, and then we add 5,000 user blocks as part of the design. So we don't say 50,000 mailboxes. Even if that's the ultimate endpoint, we still give you 10 scale units for that piece, because, as we said before, lifecycle management is also about adoption time. Sorry.
So two questions on this. And the first one is you've already kind of modeled the demand, if you will, by saying 1,000 concurrent users. What do you do when that could be a little more flexible? So one partner I'm working with is in a situation where they're looking at, it's a mobile device related solution. They expect they're going to have people really be on this for the first 30 days, and then after that we'll taper off to a more steady use. So you almost end up with a peak and a valley. And then the second thing is, more so wanted to hear your thoughts. I mean, I've done the concept of the scale unit, but I also combine that typically when I'm talking to larger scale customers about the concept of a partition. Because just like with your SAN, I'll eventually get a point where it can't scale anymore. I'm of the opinion that scale units will eventually hit a point where the management of all those scale units can become burdensome. Mm-hmm. Maybe you need a partition and have, I usually just refer to it as a whole other cluster that sits in parallel.
Yeah. So two questions or observations and some good experience being shared. First one, customer mobile scenario expects that the first 30 days will be very hip and big, and then it will go down from a demand perspective and be more steady state. How do you deal with that?
New users.
Yeah, so new users specifically. You actually provision against your demand with flexibility. So the data centers normally what they do is they plan for a given demand, let's say 80%, and then they have a 20% capacity buffer. And so in your scenario for the mobile thing, I would say between 50 and 70% of what you anticipate, and then have a capacity buffer that you kind of either pre-provision or you at least keep warm, so that if users come in rapidly, that you can fairly quickly provision. The second observation was, at some point in time, scale units, especially if you pick them too small, become cumbersome. Because if you grow a lot and you add a lot of scale unit, with each scale unit comes management overhead. It's very much like a cell when you look at a human body. A cell effectively has a control unit on top of it. So if you have multiple cells that are working together, they get to group together, and that's a control unit. Each cell does its thing, but there is a control unit associated with that. And scale units do the same thing. You either have a cluster configuration where you have a load balancer that does understand what's going on, but it becomes complicated. And so one of the suggestions was to go then and group scale units into a concept like a partition or something like it. And that's a fine idea, yeah? Especially when you get into big scenarios where you really have unforeseen demand. I'm sure the Facebook guys, I mean, Facebook rewrote their app 3 times at least, entirely, because it didn't, every time they thought they had it figured out, they hit another order of magnitude and it blew apart again. A lot of our online premises had similar experiences where they thought, yep, we finally nailed it, and then they found out there's another dependency in there that actually doesn't work like that, and they had another magnitude, orders of magnitude more users, so they had to rethink a lot of their stuff. There are two thoughts to that. First of all, it's a great idea to start grouping things together and manage them as a unit, so call them partitioning. And there is no religion with respect to changing scale units. So you can go back and say, darn, I now know more than I used to know before, so I make my scale unit bigger, smaller, or whatever the thing might be. One of the suggestions I have for you there is to introduce a concept that has to do with time. So the way, for example, we buy machines, we classify hardware by model year. Because when you look at a, let's say, a scale unit for model year 2008 and a scale unit of model year 2013, the hardware is going to be wildly different. And so when you looked at, let's say, I can handle 15,000 users with 1,000 machines of model year 2007, artificial scenario. I can handle those 15,000 users most likely with 2 machines by now. Again, also artificial scenario. So you kind of change the way you think about it because your systems, your stuff becomes more capable. And so thinking through that you say this is the scale unit for the year blah is not a bad strategy as well. And you can go back and say, nope, my new model year strategy is another one if you see fluctuation. So if you have 100 scale units running around and you don't have much flux in them, maybe you don't, you are wrong in the sense of, man, this is fairly stable for a year, it hasn't really moved. So do we simplify the architecture and get rid of some of the overhead that scale units bring?
Well, that's part of it, but the other part also is just capacity demands. Mm-hmm. We mentioned earlier this morning, essentially 8,000 cores per cloud service.
Yep.
Then you start getting
today
thinking massively scalable, you do have to think in mind, if I'm ever going to hit that limit, I need to have a way to partition my loadout. If we start adding failure concepts into it, okay, now I'm looking at doing that to also be able to spread load among multiple data centers to increase my availability.
Yeah. So the observation was when you think about the ultimate size of the cluster is of a given N. The number is 8,000 that was thrown around, but that is constantly changing, trust me. You need to think about how you put it into other clusters, how you scale, and then you get into geoscaling. How do you deal with that? And so the scale unit concept is complicated, as we have talked about, but it's still essential as part of a modeling in this kind of era of unknown capacity. Remember, unknown. The what?
You think about ASP.NET
yeah.
5 years ago, and you take now ASP.NET 4.5, SignalR, and that stuff, you get much bigger scale
yeah.
when you switch the runtime.
Yeah. So the observation was that if you're building a system with ASP.NET 1.0, let's say, and you go to ASP.NET as it is today, the system ASP.NET has changed quite a lot. And that's true for all the other software systems that we ship as well. And so the scale unit concept applies conceptually, but is also influenced not just by hardware, but is also by software, very clearly. And so modeling dependencies and understanding what that is important. So one concept we haven't talked about, I'm not sure we have it in the slides, but our Premier folks do that a lot, called service management or service modeling. So they have official service modeling tools based upon the System Center Ops Manager concepts, but they have done some extensions to that. So if you have a Premier friend, maybe he shows you the tools. They're very protective of those things. So they've done a bunch of interesting service modeling where you can actually model your scale unit and the dependencies you take and see, this capacity has shifted from ASP.NET 1 to ASP 4. We now get 10 times. So do I need to rethink my scale unit and optimize based upon my scenario? Again, these things are all in flux all the time because things change. The only point that we really want to make here, think through what the unit of capacities you want to manage and deploy and scale. And always assume that you don't know what you don't know. Meaning the capacity that you assume is always going to be wrong. Either too much capacity that you provide or too little. And this is actually a way of dealing with that uncertainty. That's really the way I would summarize this discussion. Mark, anything?
So the one thing I would say is when we get to the tool discussion this afternoon, to Uli's point, these demands are going to change over time. Facebook's scale units from year 1, year 3, year 5 are going to be pretty dramatically different. So we actually look in terms of how do you capture this with your customers in a way that you can change these things out, but they're still going to map to Thursday, May, or March, I may have high demand, and I know that, but what high demand is going to map to will change in year 2 and year 3. So we do have some ways that we can very easily help you capture that and change it over time. But they don't expect that they're going to be the same way forever, but it's a great way to look at them. The other thing is from a costing perspective, if you want to deliver X amount of nines or to be able to deliver on this for customers. If you can price out the scale unit, whether you're dealing with an enterprise, a public sector organization, or a startup, you can say, if you become wildly popular, here's what the cost will likely be. Especially for public sector, they do their budgets for the year, and you know they're not like a for-profit enterprise where being wildly successful actually could hurt them because they might not be able to afford it. You can help them ask for the budget up front. But we'll look at a lot of this at the tail end of today.
And remember throttling? Scale units are also another way to throttle demand. When you say a Black Friday, everybody is hot on your product, which is kind of a good thing, but you actually don't have budget to cover the website where they all ask for stuff. You can throttle the scale unit, so don't grow. Stop right here. So you can put an ultimate stop in there and say, until here, I will grow and then I won't. If that's a good thing or not is a business decision, not a technical one. And again, just some graphics to give you some ideas of how that works. So you start off with a single scale unit and then you grow and then you shrink again. And you grow in scale units, not in single things, not a VM here, an ASP.NET server there, that kind of thing. Fault and upgrade domains, most of you are familiar with them. Let me walk you through where they come from and how we use them in the service called Windows Azure and in Bing and in Windows in Hotmail and so forth. The fault domain concept comes from hardware. When we did our analysis in our data centers of what is the most likely component to fail, we actually found it was the mini switch on top of a rack. Because the layer 2 switching up there is not very expensive hardware, and we didn't want to put duplicate hardware in place, so we said that's a fail unit or a failure domain. And Microsoft at the scale of Bing or Hotmail said if we lose a rack, that's okay, because we're so big, a rack is the unit of failure we accept. And that's the right way of saying it. It's the unit of failure we accept. That means for all of your customers, that acceptance might be way smaller because a rack today in today's density is quite a lot of compute power. I've seen people looking at it, I have half a rack and that's my entire IT department. Those customers we service as well, not as often as this one thinks, but still it's much bigger than that. So what we have done effectively using the fault domain concept is think about the fault domain as the vertical slices of hosting machines and software. And we use the fault domain concept in Windows Azure to say, we will guarantee that you will be deployed at least in 2 racks. Because it doesn't help you if you have two virtual machines and they get deployed in the same rack. If the likely failure is the switch, your entire service is off. So good old Azure is now making sure that you get distributed at least into 2 racks. If we, for example, only have two fault domains, but we have 4 roles, then we will probably make sure that the roles are guaranteed indifferent. So if one rack fails, your service is still fine. That's really how we do that. And we use the physical side. Again, remember, Azure service orientation, they read the book, they implemented it right into the hardware in the way we use the network to isolate things and so forth. So that's what a fault domain does. An upgrade domain is the horizontal side. Now we have a bunch of servers running your software, a number of roles, and now you want to do an upgrade. And so all of us most likely will be familiar with a rolling upgrade pattern. And that's really what upgrade domains are. They actually talk about how do you go a rolling upgrade through your entire system so that your system gets updated piece by piece and percentage in percentage, and then at the end of the day you have the new version up and running without the service being ever down, if that's desirable. You can make it this way so that you're running the old software version until the new software version is partially deployed, then you do a load balancer flip, and then you bring up the rest of the software up to date and go from there. The interesting thing, Mark Rusinovich talks about this much more eloquent and in much more detail about this than I do. So there's a lot of sessions from TechEd, TechReady, that where Rusinovich talks about fault and upgrade domains and how the OS does all this magic. So if you're interested, go listen to Mark. It's actually very fascinating and it's useful to know how that all works. But the important piece for us is to think about this and saying, how can I use this to my advantage in order to think about my workloads, my life cycle, and all this other stuff so I can effectively not play with Azure, but I can use Azure's concept to also think about what is my fault domain. How do I want to make sure that I deploy? The simplest one is, sure, I have multiple copies of the same stuff. My web server runs 5 copies, 5 times. But there's more sophistication that you can do in saying, okay, if I decompose by workloads, I need to make sure that the workloads are actually also available multiple times and so forth. We talked about the little singleton before. We don't want singletons. Singletons are bad. Single copies of something means they're not available if something breaks, and as we all know, things break all the time, so we cannot assume those kind of failures. The other piece on upgrade domains is we talked about that systems are available, individual components, be they services, be they workloads, be they roles, might not be available. And you can play with that. You can use the upgrade domain concept to have parts of your systems being replaced while other parts of the systems are fully functional. And have degraded service from a performance perspective or capacity perspective, but it's still there. And as you have seen from Mark's point, big systems, all of them, lie and cheat. Meaning they are telling you something, yes, user, I'm here for you, I'm serving you, I'm all is good, when actually, no, it's not. When you look at any big system that scales at very large scale, they all lie to you. The best one that everybody, I'm sure, has experienced because you travel is the travel reservation systems. They're changing a little bit today because you now can actually ask for seats and those are a little bit more tightly controlled. But in the good old days, you call the guys and say, hey, I would like to fly from here and there. And their system said, yep, absolutely, guaranteed. They hadn't done anything yet because, A, you can change your mind. So people tend to be I got the date wrong. And so you didn't want to bother the backend system, the database, the business logic, until the user says click. Then you start working. So today we will do this modeling a web with a shopping basket. And until the user clicks checkout, nothing goes to our backend. No database is bothered, no message bus is being harassed, and all these other things, because users tend to be very, very kind of chatty and they change their mind and doing this and that and the other. So try to avoid harassing backend systems. And when the user says done, you say confirmation number, blah, 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 reservation code, this and that, send him an email or her an email, and then you start working on his or her behalf. Because A, you control the speed of execution and so forth. So you can play around with these kind of ideas where, hey, I want to change my backend. So that means my front end is cut off. The upgrade domain is my backend logic. My front end is still alive, but today they only work on cached data. I'll track all my queuing trends. I queue all my transactions against the system in a database, in a queue, whatever. And when my backend says I'm back, then I go process. So that's why I'm pushing on this fault and upgrade domains, because in the normal Windows Azure sense, you don't get to play with it. But if you build a complicated, high-scale system, you want to play with these guys and saying, I have my business backend to be available in 5 fault domains or only in 2 and my front end in 5. So you can play with these things and use workload partitioning to also look at upgradability and so forth.
And the business can figure into that too.
Yes.
So me and a friend did presentations on failure. We were talking about if you've got a supplier and you have a bad relationship with that supplier, what you may do is you say, we have 5 available in the warehouse, you actually have 10, to guarantee that you'll never hit that bottom so you don't have to wait 3 weeks for the supplier to come out. So just like we had earlier,
yep.
From a business standpoint, you can build those in scenarios,
yep,
as well to help you with that problem.
Yep, so the observation or the experience shared was that, again, business can play a role here as well. If you know that the supplier is lying to you a lot, meaning they're unreliable and they're not shipping on time as they promised, You might state your inventory lower than it actually is to make sure that the replenishment triggers earlier to compensate for possible delays. So that's kind of the way I use these kind of tools to help me with my system design.
Before we leave on this, so if you think about this, we talked about failure points and failure modes. Guess what? I have a failure mode where that machine or this physical rack could go offline. They're going to do the analysis, and they're going to remediate that by using fault domains. Similar to upgrade domains. We had a story when Azure was fairly new. There's actually a Microsoft guy from someplace in Europe, I won't say where, calls me up and says, you need to fix your service. And he works for Microsoft. It's all our service. I don't work for Azure. He goes, I put a mission-critical banking app on this thing. It's going to be a big deal, and it's not working. You need to fix the service. I said, well, sir, you know, we've not met. Hi, I'm Mark. I'm happy to help you, but let's figure out what's going on. So what you can do is increase the number of instances that sometimes, well, let's go to a larger size instance that may alleviate some problems until we figure out what's going on. And we can also increase the number of instances. So it's relatively cheap. We can do that for a couple hours. That may alleviate some pain for you. Oh, we can't do that. I was like, why not? So, well, it's not designed to be distributed. It's like, well, what do you mean? So, oh yeah, I'm writing to the local disk. I'm like, all right, well, you didn't really read the thing about the fault domains, did you? It's like, okay, we'll figure that out. And what size VM are you running on? I don't know. Let me go check. Small VM. So these things are there for you, but you also need to read the manual in many cases about how you should use some of these things. You wouldn't believe some of the things that we see. One of those things is within it, we talk about redundancy. I've had some people say, we've got a great fail-safe plan in place, but it's really based on pre-cloud. Right? So beforehand, it may have made a lot of sense for you to have two different physical data centers, and I have different deployments in each of the data centers. And that is very well a good part of the plan. So you can see here we've got, you know, deployment within a data center. You can have multiple instances there. Across data centers, that works just fine, except if you are using services that happen to be running, because now you're using software. So before you had copies of hardware that was running separately with known copies of software that you were in direct control of. But now if you're using software that's provided as part of a platform, as part of a software as a service offering, that could get deployed everywhere. So you would have two deployments, but that service wouldn't work anywhere in the world, potentially. You know, look at how they went and rolled out their software. So really understand that if the services go offline, whether it's a database service or other ways, you know, how do I want to look at making that redundant and also reacting to that? One way is I can also do across on-premise in the cloud. We've talked about a couple customer examples where we've seen this. Even if you need to fail over for just a little bit, for only certain workloads, or with only certain features, that's a viable option. But make sure you look at that when you're doing your failure mode analysis. And then also look at traffic management. So how do I direct traffic to the right place? You could do this as part of your everyday work. This traffic's going to Asia. This part's going to America. This part's going to Europe, those sorts of things. There are some other issues with that, where that also becomes a single point of failure for you potentially. Because now you have something that's sitting in front of all your data centers that's saying, go here, go here, go here. But if that now fails, what's telling everyone where to go? Now you can do redundant traffic management. You can do things that are fairly high-end using third-party services and having redundant services there. You could also do some really lo-fi things too, like going up and updating the records for the site yourself. So lots of things you can do there, but just keep in mind there are lots of options here. Now here's some people talked about, or a gentleman over here mentioned talking about transient faults. That's one of the many things you can look at in terms of your application and things you need to look at in terms of cloud. Defaulting to asynchronous, just, you know, Uli's talked about distributed transactions and anything when you're taking a dependency on something on the other end, whether it's doing distributed transactions or making synchronous calls even, you just want to avoid that. And our tools have generally done a good job of helping you do that pretty seamlessly, sometimes without the knowledge of the developer in many cases. But transient faults is one area where people tend not to, their code, there's nothing that stops people from doing this historically, and if you follow this pattern on-premise, without even a cloud model, your software will be better for it. But it tends not to exist. When we see people moving to the cloud, this is one of the areas where they have problems. And invariably, the place they see it first is with the Windows Azure SQL DB. So what does this mean? It means that you're consuming a service. You've taken a service dependency on a service that is not available 100% of the time. So it is entirely possible and actually very likely that if you call SQL Azure DB, you need to remember the branding, Windows Azure SQL DB, if you call that 100 times, 5 or 10 times that you make those calls are not going to come back the way that you would expect them to. Either you're going to get an error, then you just call them again and they work just fine. That's a transient fault. Something is going to happen. somewhat randomly, how do you react to that? And one of the things we're going to talk about is this concept of a circuit breaker pattern. So Netflix, while we pointed out the issue they had over the holidays, they actually have done quite a good job as far as implementing the circuit breaker pattern, so they have the max amount of uptime, and we'll talk about that on the next slide. And then automate all the things. That's like a meme. There's a picture of a really funny guy with his hands out, big buggy eyes. But what it means is everything has an API. Infrastructure has an API. The services have an API. Script as much as you can for the things that you know, and make sure you test them so that you remove human error. Because invariably, when you see things that have gone really bad, I talked about that site that had a test database in production for 45 minutes. It was because the guy just decided to post something up there. Or if we look at the issue I talked about earlier where it went from scaling to failing because someone made that change in Bitly. Well, guess what? That guy actually compiled it on his local machine and pushed it up to the cloud. He did not necessarily go through proper ALM practices. To echo for the video, one of the questions was, shouldn't you have some point of human intervention? One of the things that they saw about the January 29th leap year issue last year is there was a human intervention or an HI point that happened based on a certain set of criteria that would trigger that. So we'll talk about circuit breakers here, and then we'll talk about self-healing systems later on in the talk. But if people are familiar with a circuit breaker is in your home, for the most part? So you're going to get a surge of electricity, something's going to happen, and it will switch from the on to the off position to help protect your home. So if you look at Netflix, is a company that streams media to people over the web and a number of different devices, including our Xbox and our Surface devices. One of the things that they do is they have this concept of a queue. The queue is the list of movies that I would like to watch, or people in my family or attached to my account would like to watch. One of the things, if you looked at outages from the past, they've been able to do is say, you know what, we have an issue with our data store, but we have your most recent queue or a fairly recent version of your queue inside of a cache someplace. So if I lose this data store, I've looked at the failure mode I've done a failure mode analysis, I could lose that service. For most people, they're not constantly changing that queue. I can keep that in a cache. If I lose that, I can go ahead and pull a cached version of that, and people are generally none the wiser. I've decomposed my application by workload. The streaming video piece is actually someplace over here in its own workload stream, and I should arguably be able to pull that queue information down, let people potentially make some additions or deletions to that that may show locally, and then I'm sort of queuing up for changes later. And if they want to watch that movie, well, that's going to go to another workload, which ideally is still operational. If not, it has its own reactions in place, what they'll call fallbacks, which we'll look at in the next slide. But let's take a look at Netflix. What are some of the things that they look at in terms of their circuit breaker? So a request to remote service times out. Okay, so I'm going to make a call, not getting a response. That server may be offline, it may be throttled, it may be unhealthy for some reason. You could have a thread pool and a bounded task queue used to interact with it with a service dependency at 100%, or you could have a client library that's going to be throwing some exception that you need to deal with. And what you're going to do is, just like a circuit breaker is going to have a certain threshold, the human intervention point is another one, right? There's certain things that are going to happen, and at those points, I'm going to react in a different way. And this is the second gratuitous slide. I promised you two in a minute. In addition to snow, we have a working circuit breaker slide. See that move down? You're going to identify what the thresholds are, and then you're going to have certain reactions to that. So it may be, going to this gentleman's point, the first thing we may do is say, you know what, I'm going to just try and retry that. And for the first five tries, that makes sense. Five times I've tried, it's not worked. What do I want to do next? Well, I'm going to have a series of fallbacks, and one of those may be that this is you know what, we've gotten to a point where I don't know what's going on. It's been enough time that it's a concern, and I'm going to alert a human to come take a look at this. And depending on the criteria, I may send them an email. This is something you might want to take a look at. I might send them a page. I might invoke something like with Tell Me, where I'm going to initiate a call to that person wherever they may be because they need to take a look at it. Now, your error threshold rates are going to be fairly different based on your system. We've done, as I said, large social networking sites where it's not uncommon to get 10,000 issues in the course of just a couple of minutes, and that's perfectly fine. You'll just see some noise in the data, some things that may be a little off based on a scenario, and you can take a look at that. But in other cases, if I'm doing a trading desk where I've got a large investment bank, maybe five errors is significant. Maybe one error is significant, and I want to bubble that up to someone. So once you've identified that, you can do a fallback of some kind. So in the case of Netflix, they have three. So one is a custom fallback, right? So you can provide an evocable callback method or use some locally available store to react. So the Netflix example I use is, hey, you know what? I can't reach you. I've tried five times. I don't know what's going on. I'm going to go ahead and use the cache. It could also be, anyone here in financial services or done financial services work? couple folks. All right. So in financial services, there are certain constraints you have in terms of time to file on certain types of activity. If you don't, if you have a mutual fund, for example, if you don't have the right prices for the securities at the end of day, when you go to price, you're going to have to publish a price regardless. And whatever price that you publish, you have to honor that the next day. And there are certain things that can happen where if you don't have the price or you don't have what's called corporate action, so you might have a stock split or something like that, you may have to honor the price of the stock the next day, even though it may be off, and it can be millions of dollars in deltas there. So historically, they've always used multiple sources. You've had Reuters and Bloomberg providing stock prices. So if I can't get the data from Reuters, I'm going to get it from Bloomberg. If I can't send email with SendGrid, I'm going to send it with this person over here. But you're going to have that custom fallback there. The other thing is you might do is you fail silent. So think about the Facebook example I mentioned earlier, right? There's the notionally my profile is a 23-table join. Now, they don't use a relational database table, but there's a lot of different types of data. So if you can't find out what my favorite ice cream is or where I went to school, do you want to not bring back my profile? Well, probably not, right? So what you can do is you can fail silent and just return a null back if the data is optional. You can think about in any number of scenarios where I can't get access to this one piece of data. Is it really an all or nothing thing? Well, in most cases, it's not. Most is fine. So go ahead and fail silent. And the last thing you can do is, or Netflix does, is called fail fast. So I don't know what's going on. I'm just going to fail. It may cause some errors on the UX side, but I'm just going to fail. Because you know what? Remember we talked earlier about that pulse throttling and throttling? Well, if the reason why I'm having an issue is because I've got some traffic I was not expecting, and now I'm constantly hitting this service, and this service is saying, you know what? You're on a timeout, Mark. You're going to have to wait for 5 minutes, and it's going to keep moving that five-minute window until I stop making a call. Well, it's probably better for me to stop calling. It's also better for me if there are other apps that are using, maybe this is an identity service that I'm using. What you don't want to do is take that service and make it unhealthy for everybody who might be calling it. Any situation might have like that, fail fast. And if you've done a good job on the UX, you can usually dance around it in a little way. Going back to the custom fallback, you'd be amazed at what you can do with a good cache and a good caching strategy. Most people will be none the wiser. And there, as long as you can collect data when it's orders or something like that, you'll do just fine. So does that sort of answer your questions from earlier? So there would be a circuit breaker. Generally, there's an escalation path. And we talk about the designing for operations later. There's this concept of a workflow where you try to do self-healing things. And at a certain point, you would hand off to a human as part of those things. But we'll go into that in a lot more detail there. But the circuit breaker is the key part that sort of kicks off that process. OK, data. I know people were looking at data earlier. So we're going to talk about data in terms of decompositioning and partitioning of data. We're going to talk about the three Vs. It's actually not just the three Vs. Gartner and Forrester, one says three Vs, one says four Vs. I'll throw in a Q for free. It's the way that we look at it, but we'll talk about that. Just making sure you guys are awake. I know it's after lunch. And then horizontal, vertical, and hybrid partitioning. We'll talk about some of the. So we talked about decomposition of the workload, but you also want to look at decomposition of the data. Right? You don't want to do partitioning for the sake of partitioning, but you should really think about whether you need to partition or not. Because if you don't, and you do need to, it's something that's going to cause a lot of pain later on. And also think about the usage of the data. So it's not necessarily just partitioning. So as I mentioned, we've done some social sites, and there are some really interesting nuances there. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised, because it's human nature, but if you are a celebrity, and you're a very popular celebrity, people want to be your friend, right? So you end up having a partitioning scheme for everyone, and then celebrities tend to have their own partition scheme, because I may have 5 million users. So Ashton Kutcher may have 5 million followers, and I may have 500 followers. Dramatically different types of dynamics in play there, and the types of interactions that you're going to see as a result of that. So really want to think about that, and then also, so you may have two different types of partitioning schemes and decomposition schemes based on what you know about your customers. And it is just, so lest you think it's just Ashton Kutcher and that sort of thing, we did another social site, but in this case it was designed for kids and kids of all ages, let's put it that way. And you couldn't pick your own name for child safety. So you were like Happy Smooshy 434 or something like that. But you could play games inside of the site, and there was a leaderboard. And what we found is that Happy Smooshy, if they did really well in these games and they were at the top of the leaderboard, everybody wanted to be their friend. And they had the same partition characteristics as other folks in these other sites we were doing. So just think about, if you're doing leaderboards, then people who are at the top may have different types of interactions, different types of data usage, different types of things you want to take a look at, and it should be reflected inside of your policy, inside of your partitioning and how you set things up. It also reduced the logic in your SQL databases. CRUD is fine, but beyond that, You really want to think about what you do there. The other thing to think about if you do this is that we've talked about the ability by decomposing at the workload level that you have the choice of choosing different technologies. That isn't just when you start. If you look at Facebook for some of their workloads, they have changed the data technology 3 or 4 times. It's like, hey, let's try something that's more like Bigtable. Hey, let's try Cassandra. Let's try these other things. And the other nice thing about decomposing by workload is you can take something that maybe is not a priority workload and experiment with that, see how that works in production, and then move it over for some other things. But definitely you want to apply decomposition to your data layer. So the three Vs, a lot of talk about these, but it's really important to understand. And what I see people sometimes get into trouble is they don't necessarily understand the three Vs, or they haven't asked the right questions about that. So the first one is volume, right? So how big is the data set that I have, right? Is it a petabyte? Is it a terabyte? Is it a few hundred megabytes? And then how fast is it growing? If it's a petabyte, but it's a petabyte for all the data we've ever collected over the last 20 years, and then we only grow at a few hundred megabytes or a couple gigabytes a year, that's probably fine for you to put into the cloud. When we first started going to Windows Azure, I had to be the guy to let down the sales guys. They're all excited. They come and say, oh, it's awesome. This telco, they want to go to the cloud. We're going to do it. And we're going to push all their data up there. And I'm like, here's a physics book. It's like, what do you mean? You got to move. How much data do they have? They have every single call, every single text message for everyone in the entire country that they service. How many customers do they have? How many phone calls do you think they make in a given day? Okay, how much do you think that data might be? Okay, how long does it take you to move a file from a Word document from there to there? Okay, imagine that times foo. And you realize you just can't, if there's certain things that are running on-premise at that volume and they want all of it, the physics just don't work, right? And we don't have a service where you can put it on a disk and drive it up or have it sent over to us yet. So understanding the velocity is key. And then understanding, we'll talk about queryability in the next page, which may offset velocity, but really understanding that is key. And then the variety. So what types of data are involved? So when we start looking at partitioning later on, especially vertical and hybrid partitioning, understanding the varieties of data that you have are going to be critically important, because you're going to be able to do things in different ways that may be more performant, may be more cost effective. We see lots of people putting images in SQL DBs, which probably does not make sense, but we'll talk about that as we go. Queryability. So I had a really interesting discussion when I first started getting into Azure. I was talking to one of our distinguished engineers over in the SQL Azure space, and we talked about the three Vs. The three Vs were new at that time. And he said, yeah, 3Ds are fine, but you need to understand queryability. I said, queryability, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you need to understand, it's great to understand what data you have and how fast you're growing, but you really need to understand what is it you want to do with it, because there are going to be multiple options as far as what you can do. There are going to be different choices for that, and sometimes you'll end up using multiple technologies. So what do you want to query and how often do you want to query it, right? So do I want this in near real time? I want to effectively do event processing on the data as it's coming in. Do I want to be able to get reports once a day? You know, Uli talked earlier, you know, someone assumed that they wanted to have this data in the mainframe over in DP2 in real time, where they really didn't care unless it got there for 24 hours. Sometimes it's once a week. Maybe we just want to do quarterly reports or annual reports or those sorts of things. And based on when they actually need it and what they want to do with that, they may require different stores for different things, and they may be able to do that based on these two criteria, so basically what and when. So it's entirely realistic for me to do one thing with the table store because I want super fast response time. I can have a partition of one for no, as small as one with no discernible additional cost. As far as a SQL Azure database, you need to partition. There's a cost per database. There are certain costs that come with that. And that's great, but then when I want to do my reports, I want to do some relational type of work. I want to look at aggregations. So maybe I can have a process that will pull stuff out of the table store and then put it into a relational database that I can go ahead and either do reports off directly with my own stuff or with reporting services, or maybe tie into another system I'm using that's expecting a relational store. So 3Vs and queryability, absolutely key. Now, partitioning. What I'm going to show you today is for explanation purposes only, right? This is going to give you the key concepts. For anything you're doing of significant size, you're going to use these concepts as well as some interesting content from my colleagues over in the CAT team have published some papers on how to do partitioning, specific algorithms that you might want to take a look at. But these will explain the key things. If we're looking at horizontal partitioning, this is pretty straightforward. I have a number of customers. I have a number of products. They all have a name. I'm going to be able to sort of divvy them up into different databases, and that works just fine. You could also say that you may do this by orders, by year, by month, you know, anything like that. A lot of times, if you think about, I talk a lot about social, this happens a lot, whether it's you're looking at something like you'd use the enterprise like Yammer, or externally, if I'm building a system for my CRM, if I'm building something around CRM or customer management, those sorts of things. It's not uncommon for me to have, or customers, I'm going to have a list of names, I'm going to have a photo, I'm going to have a thumbnail. Right? In these cases, we actually have three different stores that make a lot of sense. SQL Azure DB for the relational store is absolutely fine. We might use the table storage for the thumbnail, it's relatively small. And then for photos, we're going to stick them over into to blob storage. But what you're going to find typically is you're going to end up with a hybrid partition. Right? So I'm going to do horizontal partitioning. I'll do vertical partitioning for the customer base information, the demographic information. And then I'm going to do a hybrid partition on that within there based on their name. And then I'll continue to keep the thumbnails and the photos out. As I've alluded to a number of different times, based on the three Vs and the type of scenario that you're in, you may want to partition a little bit differently. Right? So if you're doing social, really popular people, mostly popular people, things are going to be a bit different. If I'm doing orders, you'll hear Mark talk tomorrow about, and we'll talk a little bit today about telemetry, like the volume of information you can get. If I'm monitoring lots of things within a 60-second span, I've got 1,000 machines that I'm running, it's lots of data. What's the best, even within a 60-second span, it can be a lot of noise. So I can either filter what's going in, or I can make my partitions even smaller. But really, you want to think about that as you're going through your app. In terms of threats to data availability, you've got data center hardware and software issues. You have stuff called, force majeure, which is in a lot of people's contracts. And people are like, well, what is force majeure? Basically, something could happen like the data center gets blown up, right? Or something, the country goes to war and they cut all the power lines and that sort of thing. That could definitely take you offline. Data center destruction that we listed up there. Internet outage. There's the joke about the fiber-seeking backhoe, right? There's a backhoe that Uli was talking about in terms of burying the cow. That happens a lot. Scary, but true. You know, a farmer with a backhoe can take out a lot of internet usage. Temporary data center outage, you know, a number of things could happen there. Application errors, we'll talk about those in a minute, but lots of things that could take you offline.
Caching. The caching business is something that most of us are very familiar with. A lot of models that I've seen are fairly simple, which is not bad. Simple is good. As some very famous people say, low-tech wins. Always look for the low-tech solution, not the high-tech solution. And caching comes in various disguises in terms of you have the internet cache now in the browser. So HTML5 has an official caching strategy, or HTML has for a long time. Now we have distributed caching on the back end. So lots of different ways of doing this. I'm not necessarily going to go through all the various technologies. What I want you to take home is how you model the caching strategy, because caching is all about data. And as I mentioned a number of times before, there is a lot of different characteristics to data. And unfortunately, we're not necessarily as diligent as we need to be in order to understand those characteristics. The key thing for me in caching strategies is to understand the behavior of the data. What is the nature of the data you're trying to cache? And Pat Halland, who is one of the, I would say, core fathers of distributed transaction-oriented computing. He was at Tandem, he was at Microsoft, invented MTS, invented, as he says, is J2EE, incidentally, because they copied and improved upon the MTS design, so they hit a whole bunch of stuff. And when he started to look at service-oriented architecture, and that led to the SQL Server bus, some of you have also looked at, I'm sure, or used in projects, he kind of talked about four types of data. I will omit the fourth one, only talk about three, because we are now on the service side of the thing, not on the device side of the solution. And the service side deals with three pieces of data. If you do naive modeling, everything is resource data, and it's shared. So whenever you have dealt with a system that has hot data in a database is all about intense sharing. There's demand for given information from lots of people, lots of apps. They're trying to get to the same data. In lots of ERP systems, the inventory table is this hot data, because everybody wants to ensure that when they ask for a certain number of widgets, that they are in inventory and they can get them out of the inventory so that they can give them to their customer, for example. And I'm sure you guys have seen lots of these kind of hot tables before. And the database guys have done an amazing amount of work and an amazing job of pretending that this problem doesn't exist and help you as an app developer say that problem doesn't exist. Don't worry about it. If you go back to SQL Server before 7, we only had page level locking. So that was a fairly big physical database page that got locked. And then SQL 7 introduced latches. The same happened on the NT operating system. We had threads only, which were fairly heavy, and we introduced fibers, those kind of things. So we tried to make the unit of lock smaller and smaller and smaller because of this little problem. And what most people don't really understand is resource data and business modeling also go hand in hand. I will come to a lot of these examples throughout the rest of the discussion, but always think information modeling is an art and an unbelievable tool to reduce friction on this problem. So Pat introduced these two as official data types. They are not new. They have been around in information modeling forever, but it became part of the service-oriented modeling lore when Pat and other people started to talk about it. So he introduced formally a concept called reference data or master data. Lots of people use that already. But he added two things to it which I find important also in this kind of service-oriented design for scalability. Reference data is immutable. For those who are not necessarily native English speakers, immutable means can never ever be changed. That version of data that you gave out of your database into another form, whatever that form takes, XML, paper, whatever, CD, doesn't matter. That piece of data is always valid until it's not. And until it's not means when you expire the data. So let me give you an example of how that's being used. In the good old days, when you didn't have the internet, people would get bombarded with these catalogs from Sears and other places that were trying to sell you good service and good product. And they shipped you these catalogs, printed out, glossy, all these good things. You called Sears up, 1-800-SEARS or 1-800-whatever, and the first thing these guys asked you after introducing themselves is which version of the catalog did you use? And you knew, looking on, spring 2013 or winter. And then they said, yep, let's go ahead with the order. And when they said it was spring 2012, they said, sorry, madam or meister, I have to send you a new version of the catalog because I cannot go back that far in my reference data because that's what it is. So the catalog, physically printed, is perfectly expression of master or reference data in this context. It's immutable. You can pass it around. You can print it. You can do all sorts of things with it because the service doesn't care anymore. It only cares about the knowledge that it's data from my catalog or from my master data, and it is this version. And a good service has an understanding of how much data it sent out so that you can come back and say, nope, this is not valid anymore. So requires open schema for interop. That's very much in the service-oriented space. If you don't do that in your service design, intra-service design, that's okay. You can choose your own format. But in the inter-service design, you should use an open standard for exchange of data. And very, very powerful tool. Because reference data, you can also ship to a mobile device. Because if the form gets clicked on and you open the data and you fill in the form, it's immutable, right? As long as it's still valid, it's perfectly fine. So you can distribute it to God knows on all endpoints of the world. Perfectly cool. And then we introduced a trick, again, nothing new, but it became more popular because of the scale problems that you have when you go into very, very large scale systems. We introduced a thing called activity data. Best example is good old shopping basket. So what are we trying to do here? Remember the travel example that I said before? We're trying to avoid touching the resource data. We do not want to go back to that database at all costs. Try to relieve the pressure of the database, because the database is protecting the shared data, the stuff that everybody wants to touch. So make sure that there's a very high barrier before anybody can touch it. And so you use reference data to relieve the pressure on reading information. And you use activity data to relieve the pressure of people changing their mind. That's the best way of looking at it. Because you can say, hey, I can put stuff into the shopping basket all day long. I can take it out, I can take it in, and so forth. First of all, it's single user data, so it doesn't affect anybody. And B, it isn't persisted in terms of in the shared resource data. I don't detract inventory. I don't discount that kind of thing. So I don't go back to my database. I just collect information. And I can persist it, pass it around. I can pass it to you, to Mark, to a local device. It doesn't matter because it is identifiable. And in cases like Amazon and other popular websites, they now have services where you can keep the shopping basket persisted for weeks at a time. So you can come back and reconstitute the shopping basket and that kind of thing. And what we are trying to do, as I said a number of times, is we are trying to not touch the shared data. Try and stay away from the database. Do not touch the thing. Why is that important? It's because of scalability. People that want to use highly scalable or create highly scalable systems try to avoid writing data that is shared, meaning you have to deal with a concurrency. That's what you want to avoid. And these are tricks to avoid that kind of stuff. And these tricks are important when coupled with business modeling or information modeling. So the first time when I bought something on Amazon, you get struck with something really weird. So we are used to looking at the system information, and it says a number. Number of books available, 55 of that given book or given CD or whatever it is. And guess what? Amazon said usually available in 96 hours. So they did something very interesting. They said usually, meaning they were hedging, and 96 hours, which was their kind of SLA. And that meant it didn't matter if they had 55, 5,000, 5 million of these thingies on hand in their inventory. So they never had to go back to the inventory table to check, because their business policy said, you know what? We are going to look into making it possible for you to get your book in 96 hours. That's really the way you have to read it. And even if they had to go to Barnes & Noble to buy the book and ship it to you, it's not none of your business. That's the way we do this. And we don't have the guts to do that in our systems. We don't hide information. We are so proud that we can go back to the database, run into the database, bring it back and say, there are five. If you wanted 500, you really are disappointed now because 495 are missing. If you only wanted two, you really say, who cares? I want only two. I don't need to know that there are five. But we are so brain trimmed to say, let's go back to the database, get the latest information and show it, that we do all the time. The fallacy of real-time computing is what I call it. We don't do real-time computing here anyway because we don't guarantee signal runtime and those kind of things. So it's always really enough time in the first place. Play around with hiding information. Model information. Don't bother the database with stuff that you don't need to ask for. Have business policy in place. Another thing that you can do with this modeling concept is when you go to a hotel, what do you book? What do you reserve when you go into a hotel? You reserve what's called a fungible resource. You're asking for attributes around a room, not the specific instance of a room. So you're trying to delay binding to the specific instance of the resource as late as possible. So you're saying, hey, how many rooms of a given type are available with non-smoking, king bed, whatever the attributes are that you want to offer or that you want to share. But you never, ever, in the ideal case, share that you want to room 1, 2, 3. There are so hotels that offer that service for honeymoons or whatever, where I said, well, I got married, I stayed in room blah, and I want to stay in room blah again. Well, you can charge extra for that. The rest gets fungible rooms, and it gets late binding to the resource, as late as possible. So it's reference data, and I can put activity data against the pool of my resource and count down. How many people have asked for this? So I make it, don't make the specific rooms available, but I deduct the availability out of the pool, stuff like that. Remember, the goal is don't bother the database. And that's the way a lot of these systems are now architected, because they're combining technologies, various stores, caches, and so forth, with information modeling using these three concepts as their anchor point of how to do that. And I'm drilling on this because a lot of times we've gotten into rescue mode in projects. When customers said data is data, no problem, it's all the same, It has the same attributes. And everybody here says, wait a second, that's not possible. Trust me, that is the default, not the exception. It's the other way around. And the second thing is a cache, a distributed cache, is not a database. Everybody assumes that every store has ACID transactions, ACID atomicity and all this other good stuff that we have in our transaction book that we all live and love. ACID transactions are awesome. But table store doesn't support them, distributed cache doesn't support them, and so forth. So a lot of the technologies that we are now using without thinking much about them doesn't support ACID transactions. And pretending doesn't help. So there is no hiding updates from anybody. Any update is visible right away to everybody. So you do a dirty read in database language all the time. And people are not aware of it because they are so used to the relational database features and capabilities that every persistent store has to have the same. You have no idea how many times we went in saying, why are you doing that for? It's a database, isn't it? No, it's not. It's a distributed cache. It just gives you faster access to data. That's all it does. And that's good for, and it's awesome, but it doesn't do what a SQL database does. So understand the capabilities and the attributes of the store you're using. Table store does not support ACID transactions, just in case anybody didn't read the fine print, right? So those are some of the things you've got to really think hard about. And for the services people, I really would like to see more designs which actually explicitly model reference data, activity data, the information model strategies that we're suggesting to the customer, like fungibility, those kind of things, or SLAs that are not bound to specific instances, those kind of things, and really show how we can minimize the pressure and usage of the shared data. On an application design, these guys are protected deeply, deeply from users. Users never touch resource data, never, ever, because users tend to be fickle people, especially when you grab a lock and hold on to it. Don't do that, ever, when a user is involved, because users tend to do this, I need a coffee, and they walk away with an open dialogue that keeps your lock open. We don't do that most of the time anymore. I'm being very drastic here, but I'm just trying to be very black and white so that we can keep that in our head when we go forward. Let's go back to this one. Sorry?
Necessarily resource data, but you can't just throw it out the wall like reference data.
Yeah. So if it's so the question was, how do you deal with data that's effectively under governance or under rules? And the example was HIPAA with personal identifiable information. You can't throw that out as reference data. Absolutely correct. You can't do that. So first of all, resource data, it's a type of resource data because you're storing it in the database. But it depends on how you treat it, meaning, is anybody going to do a highly concurrent update against those guys? Most likely, if it's your personal information, not. It's going to be updated, but not highly concurrent. So that data type might have another one where you say, yes, it's resource data, but it's isolatable data. So that's another way I would look at it. And then it's also, you could argue it's a type of activity data because it's only you. If you make an update to the streets, to your address or something like that. I don't know how many of people can do that. So for me, it doesn't fit quite into the scheme because it's such an isolated piece of data for PII, because that's about person and identifiable. So low concurrency updates are not a problem. Databases can deal with concurrency really well. So it's resource data, treat it like that. The big problem is when you have this highly concurrent update, when everybody tries to touch the same information at the same time, then it becomes complicated. But there is a more, the general piece is, if you have data that's under regulatory compliance, outside of PII, forget the PII side, that's I don't think there is a problem here. You might have different techniques, saying, okay, I have reference data that falls under certain compliance information. Then you might have to encrypt it. You might have to give access control to say, not everybody can see all that data, and so forth. So there's a bunch of these kind of techniques where the same thing applies, but you have to protect the data differently and give grant access differently. You had a comment.
So under failure modes, this
yep.
implies being very careful that you're using idempotent operations, right?
I mean, yeah.
The resource, that would really apply to the resource data, is that correct?
Yeah. So the observation was under failure modes and failure points, there are two things in here. So the observation was, does it require idempotent or idempotent access? Because you need to be you need to be able to identify the data and the activity against the data in a unique and non-conflicting kind of way. It's always repeatable, always the same. That's idempotency. and so that's absolutely required. That's why this thing is immutable, meaning you can't, it's read-only, is another way of saying it. Reference data you can't change. You can change it in your context, but the core reference data that you use is read-only. You can't change it. This side here, you want to do idempotency on this guy, and you also want to make sure that the resource data gets changed in sequence and correctly as part of the interaction cycle. And again, that's where some complexities, you need to have queues possibly involved and stuff like that. In the modern apps course that I teach, I don't know if we have it in here, we talk about how you implement queuing and idempotency and what happens if you don't do that. But those techniques, I think, are well understood. Maybe I'm making an assumption by now because I also got told by some young friend, what is SOA? Some of these older concepts are maybe out of favor by now. So you have a comment on there? Configuration and code are the same?
Configuration and code are the same thing, treat them the same. I was wondering if that falls into the discussion of reference data, configuration data, basically, you know, maps to that, or if that's a different part.
It is a different part. So the question is, or two questions, the gentleman over there has heard that configuration and code have to be treated the same way, if I paraphrase it correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then is this kind of the same idea that you have reference data and that kind of thing? To a degree, yes. Because once you take configuration or code into the wild, meaning into the production system, those are read-only. So conceptually, you could argue those are reference data. It's not quite data. That's kind of why the analogy is kind of a little bit lame. But from a conceptual perspective, that it's read-only, it's immutable once it's out there, is absolutely correct. Why do you think we have CMDBs, where we have configuration management as part of the whole process? Because you want to change and modify data, like configuration items, on a well-managed way, and then release it and saying, this is version blah that we are now have in production. And everybody knows what is in production. Do we have lots of examples where that is true? That everybody is, yep, this is a snapshot, it's read-only, that kind of thing? Everybody treats that as live data and you can change it at any point in time. Everybody treats it actually as resource data. And it's not. It's actually this guy. So your analogy is correct, but nobody that I know of would think about it in that context. They think about it more as a life cycle thing rather than an interaction thing. But conceptually, you're right.
Yep.
So the observation or the question was here, we've talked about, or he has heard talking about consistency and concurrency availability being effectively the evil threeness that you need to deal with. And if you look at transactions, that's what they were designed to deal with. They were trying to give concurrent access to shared resources, maximizing availability and concurrency. But there is a trade-off. At some point in time, you go and run into the wall where there are latches and locks. So the granularity of the locks are becoming smaller and smaller and smaller because of the everybody wants access to the same data problem at the same time. If you look at Hackathon, which is an in-memory version of SQL Server, coming out at some point in time soon, they claim that the engine itself is lock-free. So they don't do locks in the engine itself anymore. They actually have, but it comes with a trade-off that they have only snapshot isolation, which is an isolation level in SQL. Again, different story. The whole reason why we do this is because of the concurrency and availability problem. Because everybody wants access to the same data is the assumption. And that's why you have these highly concurrent updates. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that the system that owns that highly concurrent updatable data doesn't get bothered by people. Or only as when we're done with processing the activity, then we go change the database. And there have been numerous implementation of that pattern across the world. So if you look at the mainframe, if you look at an IMS system, they effectively do this where they use messaging to update the database. So you actually don't get to update the database directly. SAP took that whole process and they combined KIX as a transaction monitor with a application level lock manager in their application layer. And they used the IMS model to update the database where the user updates the application store and they have locks on application level, but there are no locks taken on the database. And then they run an asynchronous update process after the fact and update the database. So no user can get ever into conflict with them updating their own little screens and the system effectively updating the database. So lots of variations of that theme against these three data types because of the concurrency issue. So the observation was people have been, or you can read it in the press, in the geek press, that there's talked about eventual consistency and guaranteed consistency. The database world, the transaction world, is about guaranteed consistency right then and there. And the eventual consistency is about, okay, I got a form, it runs around, and that kind of thing, and eventually we can coalesce to make this happen. Eventual consistency is a brain exercise, and most people's brains are not tuned that way. So it's very, very hard to do eventual consistency. Most people love transactions because it's easy, you don't have to think about it, the system takes care of you. That's why it's such a popular method, and the databases have done such a great job of dealing with it. When you go back to the data modeling that we just did, it is an eventually consistency model, because what we are saying is the reference data is out, it's read-only, it's a copy. The activity data says it can be passed around and it doesn't do any state changes yet, although it's logically changing the state of the shared data system because I'm ordering items, I'm putting them in. I may even go to the checkout and then I have committed the business that I will provide this good to you. And then I go against the reference resource data and update the database. That only works if you have the business policies in place, meaning eventual consistency around the fungibility of the data model. That's one, the data type. That's one model for consistency, eventual consistency, because I'm binding very late as I possibly can, to the real instance. Or the SLA-based one that Amazon does, around usually available in 96 hours. That's an eventual consistency model. But you have to have the business practice associated or policy associated with it, otherwise it doesn't work. Try not to do this as a technology exercise. That won't work. And there are data types or data things where you really don't want to do that. Again, the example I use is when now Mr. Obama would have the need to check out a nuclear warhead, you do want that to be right then and there consistent and not eventually. Right? So there are certain scenarios where a lot of the stuff what I walked you through doesn't work because it is too sensitive, too complicated, and so forth.
So you're going to talk about eventual consistency. Are you going to talk about trade-offs between NoSQL and SQL databases?
Yes, we will. Mark will, not me. Again, this is really something where we look at caching, how you get to this. You can do it logic-based, asking for priority, date-based, time-based, or volume-based. So effectively, how do you get to cache data? How do you warm up the cache? Because caches, as it turns out, are very, very useful for access time. So they're very useful in terms of reducing load on the database, making the access to the data, reference data or activity data faster, because you don't have to go back to the database. Remember, SQL Azure is a service, not a server. So don't abuse SQL Azure as a cache. It isn't. But it is something where you have to think about how do you warm up the cache, provide the data into the cache, and so forth. And the technology integration between the cache and the database is not as great as one could hope for. Because we don't do automatic loading. You can't pin saying that table or that range I would like in my cache and it automagically happens. That's not happening at this point in time. So it's you that have to start saying, how do I warm up my cache? That's a term where you simply say, which data can I preload? So that you don't have to load on demand. Get the hit first against the database and then it's in the cache. That's not going to be very helpful. Remember, there's also DR involved. If your warm cache dies, because the data center dies or the cache cluster dies, you fail over to your DR side. All of a sudden, you have to now plan for the demand going against the cold cache, meaning there is no data in there and so forth. So there's a bunch of interesting things around caching that you have to think about. Solving the item potency problem. So this is a simple example based upon a transaction against a balance sheet. So you're trying to get debit and credit. Most likely you guys would have seen this before. So we do a debit. The worker role reads the message. The transaction ID is not present. Did you only use the transaction ID example?
Yes.
Okay, so this is already the good side. So the old side, the other side is you do the debit, and before you actually have written anything and you have committed to the other side that the credit happened, the worker role gets recycled. So now the application on the web role says, wait a second, nobody read it. So now he sends the debit again and again and again, so that instead of $100, possibly thousands of dollars get debited, because there is no protection against it. That's what item potency means. In this case here, what we are doing, a message with transaction ID, so it's an artificial identity. So this is if you wanted to implement that yourself. Don't do this. Use the service bus or other similar technologies. They do that kind of thing for you. So this is just an illustration for education purposes. Don't write that code. Worker role reads the message, checks the identity is not present yet, and then writes the transaction ID with started to say, yep, started it. So now somebody else, a third party, in this case the log, keeps track of what has happened with whom and when, so that nobody can override other things. Balance debited 100%, worker role is torn before the message can be deleted. So Azure decided I need that space for somebody else, or you behaving badly, or whatever the reason is. 3 minutes later, the message reappears, but since it has the transaction ID, the log is being checked and saying, have done this already, started, did something to it, and so it's a compensating message that's being written to another queue, etc., etc., etc. The whole idea is that there is a third party, in this case the log, that keeps track of what happened and effectively can be replayed in case something like the torn worker role happens, and so that you do not repeat the activity again. Remember the nuclear warhead thing? You don't want a second nuclear warhead to be checked out of the inventory just because Azure decided to tore down your worker role that manages this checkout. And again, databases do this automatically for you. Service bus and other message queuing technology do this automatically for you. Do not build this code yourself. It's very easy to get lost because of this kind of thing. Compensatory message, blah, blah.
So does the service bus guarantee that 100%?
Nothing is 100%. There's always a time window where you can get out of sync. But it guarantees that no two messages are being written at the same time. So again, there is a lot of logic involved in this whole thing. And it guarantees it so that this guarantee, the item potency, is guaranteed. Yeah. Will the transaction go through? That is not guaranteed because there might be other things that happen that influence the outcome of that transaction. But no, it won't happen. It will happen or it won't happen. The message writing. Remember, the message writing is the transaction, not the business logic transaction. Okay? Databases take care of data security. Messages say, I wrote the message, I got the message, I'm good. And I guarantee that this message will be delivered in order and sequence and so forth. Remember, there are different types of queues. You have to be configuring the queue correctly. If you use an in-memory queue, for example, which Service Bus doesn't support, but MSMQ does, for example, an express queue, it's not persisted in the database. So if the machine goes down, you're in trouble. Okay, so those are some of the little details that you have to be aware of if you're using queuing.
So data resiliency. So one of the bigger issues, well, it's a recurring issue, you could say, all up, is that people hear something or they read something and they imply think it means more than what is necessarily true or don't necessarily think about the ramifications. So one of the things is that we can do replication of your data. We'll keep three copies of your data. So if we happen to lose something, not worry, we've got three copies, you'll be able to stay online, yada, yada, yada. Well, that's good in most cases, but if your code does something you don't expect and you corrupt the data yourself, so if someone goes and drops a table, guess what, it's dropped three times. It's dropped everywhere. Unless you do a backup, there's no copy of that. Really want to make sure you understand what's your remediation processes. When you're looking at failure mode analysis, I could do the damage. Forget the service provider. I could do the damage. Where could I do that, and what are the potential areas that could happen? In terms of backups, there are multiple types. You could do a total backup, depending on your database size, and it could be a total backup of a partition. We've done projects where the number of partitions, the number of databases has been over 500. So it's a bit of a challenge to manage all up, but the time to do a backup of an individual shard in that system is not particularly time-consuming. You do a point in time, so as of last Tuesday, as of 2 o'clock, as of 5 minutes ago, there's there. And then there's also synchronized data. So I'm putting it here, and then DataSync or some other technology is syncing it up to another database someplace else. Relational database technologies, whether you're running an infrastructure as a service or even as Windows Azure SQL DB, if you look at the SQL Server technologies, both of those, as an example, there are a number of tools and approaches and script that allow you to do backups, right? And it largely works with SQL Azure. And that's wonderful. And people have existing processes on premises, they move and migrate their applications and their workloads to the cloud. That's a wonderful thing. Sharded relational databases, NoSQL and Blob, pretty new. Those things don't necessarily exist. So let's sort of take you through what that looks like. So you've got your source, and you want to do a replica. So now you've got two copies. But the reality is that you need a log that's going over there. But now my log becomes a single point of failure, and I need to duplicate my log. Right? This does. There may be some systems out there that do this for you. I've not run across them. So you have to kind of roll your own today, because we don't have the ecosystem and the history like we do with SQL Server. It isn't just for us. It's for most things. So things you might want to take into consideration there, right? Because it's not just having a copy, but how do I know how much I've copied over from a high-volume system? How do I make sure I don't send things over twice? We talked about idempotency before, right? Same sort of thing. So something you need to take a look at. The other thing that we see some folks, there are two things to think about when you're dealing with lots of data. There's the, hey, I've got lots of data, it's cheap to store it, why wouldn't I keep it forever? And in some cases, that's true, right? Because you can get analysis off of that and whatever. But then I've worked with customers, someone mentioned pharma earlier, right, where you absolutely do not want to keep data any longer than you are legally obligated to keep it, because it opens you up to all sorts of litigation and other things like that in terms of e-discovery and whatnot. So I found that the number one place that I find people that have issues with their applications in the cloud is not in the front end, it's not in the business logic, it happens to be in the data store. And a lot of times it goes back to a single DB and it's getting some issues because they haven't thought about their partitioning strategy. Then once they've got it, they've got a great partitioning strategy, they haven't really thought through, well, when do I archive data? When do I sort of move it off to secondary storage? So maybe I've got a relational database today, can I serialize that? Can I do something with it, just stick it in another store, blob storage maybe, that I can use later on? And when do I purge it off? And it is cheap, but depending on the size of the data, how much you're doing, you want to make sure you understand that. And then based on industry, it's absolutely critical. One other thing in terms of data, in terms of making it available, we have a content distribution network. We have MacamiHasm. Depending on what your project, you may use one or the other. But there are good uses for that and bad uses of that. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, you may have an asset. It could be an image. It could be a media file. It could be some JSON. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that you've got a global audience, and maybe you're dealing with folks that are working with devices. You want to make sure that you have a really fast response time and get it to them as quickly as possible. And one way to do that is with content distribution network. So your copy that you have up on the cloud would go down to these edge locations the first time that it's requested. There's a new video that's out, or a new image that's on the, we saw in the news this morning, the Pope resigned. That's in the CNN news feed. That might be in a JavaScript file that can be downloaded to a bunch of mobile clients. That JavaScript file is placed inside of a blob service, which is then used by people using the CNN Windows 8 client, for example, or on other devices. What's going to happen is the first time that someone uses that, it's going to be called down to the edge location, and then it's going to be pulled over to the user. So it actually takes a little bit longer to get there the first time. But then all subsequent calls, everyone else in this room, first time I get it, it would take a little bit longer. If we all then went to use it, it would all come from the edge location. It would be super fast. Works great for a number of things if they're frequently used. I had a customer who came to me and said, you know what, CDN is awesome, we want to use it, we're going to compete with Amazon, we're going to build an e-book store, we're going to put 1 million books up there, we're going to put it in CDN, what do you think? I'm like, that's a horrible idea. Like, what do you mean? I was like, listen, I'd love to take your money as part of the CDN, because we charge you an awful lot of money, but you're not going to be a happy customer. And I said, I don't understand. And I said, well, have you read the book The Long Tail by Chris Anderson, the guy who's editor at Wired? I said, yeah. I said, well, he has this concept of hits and everything else, this long tail. And the hits are going to be used most often. So if you think about most things, there's the Billboard Top 100 for music. There's the Barnes & Noble Top 20 or the New York Times bestseller list. Those are the things that people want. Those are the things that access the most frequently. It could be if I'm looking at a news site or a media site, what happens to be on the homepage, those sorts of things, the stories of the day. Those are absolutely fine to put inside of a CDN, probably a really great thing to do because you're going to have a super responsive user experience, and you don't mind paying that extra hop because you know, you're going to be able to get people to use it more, you're selling ads, your monetization makes a lot of sense. But if you put all 1 million books in there, the hits are really 100 out of 1 million. Which means that every time that you call, and also with the CDN, it's going to time out. So there's a limited amount of time it's going to sit in there. So if I now have 1 million books, but only 100 get used frequently, that means every time someone goes to call up one of those books, I'm paying twice, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So CDNs are fine, but again, look at, we talked about data decomposition, data partitioning, hits, everything else. So I'm going to take a look at CDNs can work quite well for you there, but definitely only if you use the right way. So latency shifts. All right, so latency is not your friend, right? I mean, we talked about the physics of moving bits from one place to the other. The reality is we all hope, I was going to say we all have surfaces, and I don't want to rub that in for some markets that don't have it yet. So a lot of us have surfaces. Some of us will have surfaces soon. But there are phones or tablets, lots of things with varying levels of connectivity. We have latency, as Uli talked about, between services inside of the data center. We have latency between us and the data center. Sometimes it's between us and a carrier or some sort of intermediary point. And the carrier, and you really need to make sure you or the backend services, and you really need to understand what are the impacts there. We're going to talk about telemetry. We're going to take a break in a few minutes, and then we're going to talk about telemetry and design for operations. That's also you're going to be able to design for latency and keep that in mind. But telemetry is going to be key. I had someone tell me the other day, "Yeah, it's taking me 22 seconds to get to the data center and back." I'm like, "You know what? There is no way in insert your favorite expletive here that it's taking you 22 seconds to get there to the data center and back. You just don't know what's happening in your code that's causing a problem, that's introducing a delay that's there. Latency is real. Make sure you figure that into what you're doing. Take advantage of cache, as we talked about. Take advantage of CDNs where appropriate. But really understand that. Understand the types of devices that are accessing it. You can also build some intelligence in there. If for some reason you can't connect or it's slow, you can have cache, not just in the cloud. We talked about distributed cache and whatnot. But your device is a cache. So make sure you're using that as intelligently as well. But latency, make sure you understand it for your given scenario. Traffic management, we talked about this earlier. This is really just, you know, we've got policies, there's monitoring. We're going to go ahead and make sure we route this out to the right place. Maybe it's going to Europe, maybe it's going to Asia. But again, could be a single point of failure. And evaluate that, do your failure mode analysis, and decide whether you want to have a secondary service, which for a high-end site might make sense. Then there's some lo-fi options where you can go ahead and change records manually and get that to work. Cross-premises connectivity, we talked about this at the beginning. Great, allow you to do some things that you couldn't normally do. I can't necessarily move my mainframe to the cloud. I can migrate my app. I may have some things that just don't run in the cloud because of licensing reasons. They run just fine in infrastructure as a service, but Oracle, for example, is not supported in some IaaS implementations. So understanding what you can do and then you know, when you're doing your failure mode analysis, what can break and what can I do to get around that? And is that acceptable for me?
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/whack-series/whack-failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.